I'm bringing the party to you.
I don't see how that's a party.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Black Hole Cinema's Avengers Special podcast. This is the big one. This is the biggest Black Hole Cinema ever. We have a cornucopia of guests today. And I didn't think I'd say that word, but I have. I'm Tony Black, the host. I return after several weeks and leaving the podcast in the capable hands of Mr. Dan Taylor, who's here tonight. Hello, Dan.
Hello, hello.
And alongside Dan, we have, in this massive lineup, sitting right next to me, to my right, Mr. Matt Lavin.
Hello.
He saluted. You even saluted. some of those chocolates in the background. We have, in his first podcast since the old days of Black Hole Cinema, Mr. Lee Crimes.
Hello, hello.
And also, trying to one-up him in the bald stakes, but probably not succeeding, is Mr. Pete Gaskell.
Well, thank you very much.
Last but not least, foul-mouthed Black Hole Cinema beauty, Emma Platt.
Sup.
So, the plan is thus. We are going to talk about all of the 11 Marvel Cinematic Universe films to date. Now, on this podcast before, we have last summer, we did do a Marvel special podcast with a few of the guys, and we talked in general about Marvel. So we're not necessarily going to talk about the universe as a whole, but I'm sure it will come up in the actual conversations about the films. So we're going to talk this roster. Iron Man, the first one. We are then going to have The Incredible Hulk, Iron Man 2, Thor, Captain America, the First Avenger, which we have a special guest appearance by Tom East, who couldn't be here today because he's off cosplaying. Bless him. And following that, we're then going to have Avengers Assemble, the first great one, Iron Man 3, Thor, The Dark World, Captain America, The Winter Soldier, Guardians of the Galaxy, and finally, our big final all-encompassing review of Avengers Age of Ultron. And everyone is going to have specific films they've chosen to watch and are going through. So, but I'm going to kick us off with the first ever Marvel Cinematic Universe film, Iron Man.
What are you building, Stark?
Your eyes are red. Your tears for your long-lost boss?
Tears of joy. I hate job hunting.
Yeah, vacation's over.
Welcome home, sir.
Put up the scanner, will you? What happened over there?
I have my eyes open.
I want to protect the people I put in harm's way.
Okay, the first Iron Man, which came out in 2008 and was directed by Jon Favreau, who previously had directed indie films such as Swingers. So he might have been a bit of an off-centre choice for the first ever Iron Man film. This obviously introduced Robert Downey Jr., as Tony Stark, the multi-billionaire arms dealer who ends up getting himself into a bit of a pickle in Afghanistan, and ends
up a bit of a pickle. Oh no, it's a pickle.
He ends up in a bit of a pickle, which is to maybe understate it slightly.
What a British choice of words. Yeah. I love it.
I think that's in the original version, which starred Norman Wisdom.
A bit of a kerfuffle. A bit of a palaver.
Yes, so after getting himself into a bit of a pickle, kerfuffle, whichever, he ends up taking on the mantle of Iron Man when he creates himself a metallic suit to break his way out of being captured in Afghanistan, and in the end begins his journey towards becoming a superhero and starts to see the error of his ways in terms of being this multi-billionaire crusading guy. So yeah, the first Iron Man, which really does, I think, set the stall out. I love this first one. I still think this is one of the best of all the Marvel cinematic films myself. I think it's just got, Latham's shaking his head. I think it's just got all of those really cool components that make the best kind of Marvel films. It's got a really likeable lead actor playing a really likeable character, even though he's a bit of a douche at times, but he's a funny, you know, douche. It's got a good narrative, it's got a good sense of introduction and a good way of introducing the tone of the universe and the tone of Tony Stark and Iron Man while still being really exciting and kick-ass. And it's got a good villain, I think, even though he's not amazing, but Jeff Daniels. Imagine Jeff Daniels as Ironmonger.
Well, in my head, so I go to Paul Daniels then.
Why indeed? That's a question you should be asking yourself, Pete, not the rest of us.
Yes.
Admittedly, I'd watch Paul Daniels as Ironmonger, I've got to be honest. But yes, I think it's just got a really good canvas in which it paints itself on, and I think it's just really a really exciting, really fun film. I always enjoy it when I watch it, and I think it really sets the stall out very well. What do we think, guys?
Personally, I think it's one of the best origin stories of any hero, because it's purely, you know, wits and skill and intelligence getting him out of his, you know, his pickle earlier on. I think that's going to become the watchword, isn't it?
Breaking out of a pickle.
Yes.
I'll have to find the point in which every Marvel movie has the pickle.
I was just going to say,
that's the pickle.
Star-Lord gets himself into a bit of a pickle, you know.
Oh, no. Them Guardians of the Galaxy causing a right kerfuffle.
Black Hole Cinema, sponsored by Branston.
Pickle.
I think it falls apart in the last 20 minutes or so when you have Jeff Bridges / Daniels just stomping around, causing mayhem in Vegas.
As we'll cover in the other films, the third act monster fight special effects fest is a fairly common thing across several of the movies, as it turns out. But the first Iron Man movie, I think, just gets away with everything, because the one thing that they understand better than anything else is the same lesson that the Nolan Batman movies followed. You make these things as grounded as you possibly can, and the audience will just buy a lot of what's happening, even if it starts to get a little bit more ridiculous. As I'm sure we'll cover later on, the further you go from sort of basic, understandable human-level concepts in these things, the harder it is for people to buy into those and stay up with them. Whereas one dude in a powered armor suit, which, you know, we're not that far off from having in the real world now in various guises, facing off against another guy in a bigger powered armor suit, not that big of a stretch for people to try and keep up with. And I think that's why so many of the action sequences and big beats of that film work, is because the DIY-ness of the early suits that Tony's putting together and everything else that rolls with it just really does make you feel like, oh, well, this is something that could potentially sort of almost happen in the real world as it is right now. And that's what connects you, the audience, to what's going on with the rest of it.
Yeah, I think Lee's right. That's the strength of Iron Man, is that he is a human character. And that's why it's quite difficult, and you can feel quite detached with the four films, for example, is that he is a god. He doesn't have this relatability that Tony Stark does. And obviously Robert Downey Jr. does it so well that you do feel for him. And he does seem to go on a journey across the whole series of films. I watched Iron Man 3 again today, and he sees the error of his ways. He sees the man he was. He sees the man he wants to be, and it's us following him on this journey to be this, whereas Thor is already the son of Odin and, you know, a mighty god and the mighty Thor. And you know, obviously the first film, which we'll talk about later, obviously he has his own moment of pickleness, but
pickle-osity.
Yeah, but quickly he becomes the Mighty Four, and quickly, you know, Steve Rogers becomes Captain America and becomes this superhuman, and kind of leaves behind kind of the humanity of him, you know, the human inside of him that has the flaws and stuff that, you know, makes us all as crap as each other behind, which obviously Tony Stark carries throughout the whole film. Even in Age of Ultron, he's the character that has these flaws that causes all these pickles.
Yeah, and I think that's the key. I think he's quite a human character, you know, and that's why he's so likable, and I think that's one of the big reasons the film works.
And I think one thing I'd like to just quickly add is that the casting as well is quite spot on, because I think there's quite a lot of parallels that they've said that between Robert Downey Jr.'s personal life and Tony Stark. They probably aren't apparent in this film, but I think Robert Downey Jr.
Rodney.
Rodney.
We'll just call him Rod from now on.
Yeah, Rod is.
Call him Dave.
Rodney Downey Jr.
Dave Jr.
He settled into Tony Stark so well, it's like he was pretty much born to play Tony Stark. And I can't actually think of anyone else that may have been able to play Tony Stark.
It's what makes
not to that degree
movie so uncomfortable to watch, I think.
Yeah, and of course, then we get the final ending moment, post credits, the first post credits scene, which is something obviously, in many respects, Marvel have kind of pioneered. Obviously, people were doing it before, but Marvel were really the first to really make this a thing. So this is the one where we briefly see Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury, and asking him to join the Avenger initiative, and it's that point I think you realise this is a bigger thing now. This is a bigger canvas, and that obviously is followed on in the next film in the saga, which is The Incredible Hulk.
I've got a problem. There are aspects of my personality that I can't control.
See a shrink?
It's a little bit more complicated than that.
Bruce, trust me when I tell you, I've heard them all.
Not this one.
I'm one of these people who always finds myself sticking up for films that no one else ever really seems to like. As Tony can attest, I've tried to, you know, preach my love for films like Mortal Kombat and the original Street Fighter, which everyone else just slates and hates, and I think are just masterpieces in their own incredibly silly way. And The Incredible Hulk is a much better film than I think a lot of people give it credit for being sometimes. It had all the issues and the behind-the-scenes troubles with it, and Edward Norton basically getting stiffed out of the fact that he'd done a significant amount of screenwriting work on it that, through various reasons, which I think was more union-related than anything else, he wasn't able to get a proper credit for. But the vision of the character that puts forward, the way it treats the Ang Lee movie as basically a what-if, one-shot thing, and starts with its own reinvention of the character, it's absolutely spot on. It plays it much more like a Richard Kimball kind of fugitive story, which is what The Incredible Hulk should always be. This guy who's got this problem that he's trying to contain in his own time, but people won't leave him alone for long enough to do that. You know, you can fill it up with all your metaphors about whether it's someone struggling to control their own temper or their own inner demons, or just the fact that the world's kind of filled with douchebags who won't leave people alone to just sort their own messes out without feeling like they need to interfere. But again, as we were just saying a moment ago, for a lot of people, the film works quite nicely. There's some great action sequences in it. It's put together in a nice, pacey sort of way. Edward Norton is brilliant as the character, and when it does devolve into a kind of monster fight for the last 20 minutes or so, as Hulk and Abomination are slapping each other around Harlem, then that's where perhaps a lot of people lose it, and that's the image that some people take away. But, you know, if you look at other films that have ended up with a CGI crap fest and done it appallingly badly, the action sequences in Hulk, they know how to use a character like that, which is basically just a big tank. You know, you have lots of moments of, he's agile, but he's also very fast, as well as being strong. And there's a good sense of energy to all of, and inventiveness to all of the sequences that take place. When he's attacked at the university by the military, he sits and pulls something up to use his shields against the weird Godzilla-style sonic cannon things that they're using at him, rather than just blundering towards them with his arms flailing. And it's crediting both the Hulk and Banner as personalities with their own sort of sense of intelligence, their own way of problem solving, that means that the route that they go through across the films is, again, such a good one. Ruffalo's eventual slight reinvention of the character into the kind of shy nerd works for him, and it flows with everything else, because Banner himself is going on a journey as he tries to learn how to control the Hulk and how he transforms and what he does with it. But if you haven't seen it for a while, I would always recommend people to go back and watch The Incredible Hulk, because with the benefit of, what is it now, 7-8 years worth of hindsight, you would be surprised at how well it actually stands up in the overall pantheon of Marvel movies. It's, for my money, it sort of pushes past the second Iron Man and Thor movies. And even though calling something potentially like the fifth or sixth best Marvel movie just means that there's five even better movies than it, rather than it's just, you know, five places worse than those other films. But I think as an introduction to the character, as a step up from the concepts that Iron Man was putting down, to basically say to audiences, right, these are the kind of concepts we're going to be throwing at you, but we're going to introduce them a little bit at a time, kind of expand the otherworldliness and comic bookness of them a step at a time so you don't get too lost. Hulk is a nice step in the right kind of direction. Once audiences are on board with that kind of idea and that kind of action, future films like Thor and like other things that roll out after that are a much easier pill for people to swallow.
But is it better than the first Hulk film, which obviously was... This was directed by Louis Leterrier, who was like Transporter and stuff like that. But is this better than Ang Lee's Hulk, which was their first run at the Hulk films, or was it just too different a beast?
Without a doubt, it's better.
You won't like him when he's Ang Lee. That's
oh, God.
Ang Lee's is just a mess of a film. Like, it's
absolute madness, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's just insane. Like,
weirdly, Ang Lee's movie tries to be more comic book than the others. There's some really clever shots and frames and slides and attempts to sort of recreate comic book style panels sliding in on top of itself.
They tried to make it like, I don't know, it seems to me like they just tried to make it appeal to like a wide range of people. Like, I don't know, it was just too on the... I went to see that when I was like 15, and even I was like, what the fuck is this shite? It was just, it was insane. And it's just, I like Ang Lee.
Yeah.
And it was terrible. It was just absolutely terrible. Not that I like the second one anymore. I thought it was boring as fuck.
Because that's the point. Ang Lee was making quite a kind of thoughtful, slightly odd, you know, very different way of approaching it, because he didn't want to make it just a classic superhero blockbuster. He wanted to make something that was a bit different and kind of dipped into the psyche, and for some reason had a bit where the Hulk fights three giant genetically modified poodles. But obviously the marketing of that, yeah, I didn't understand that bit either. Doesn't doesn't Nick Nolte turn into a tree at one point or something?
I've not actually seen the Ang Lee version of Hulk, and I actually want to watch it now.
The thing about the Ang Lee one, as Lee kind of said, is it was trying to do something different, something comic booky. But actually, like Energy and compared to both of them, is that it's been done better somewhere else. I think Ang Lee's kind of, it reminds me a bit of the Scott Pilgrim vs. the World kind of style and kind of the more artistic way of doing it. And I said it, so it's been done better elsewhere. And the Incredible Hulk with Edward Norton, it's been done more normal, as it were, or what we've become accustomed to in the MCU, but again, it's been done better in Iron Man or in Thor or in Captain America. It's all the same kind of style, and those do it better than perhaps this does.
See,
the problem remains that Hulk is a very difficult character to build
absolutely, yeah.
A movie-length narrative around. Comic books can kind of break down what he's doing into smaller chunks or get away with him fighting more outlandish kinds of villains.
Mm.
Norton spends so much of the film as Banner rather than as the Hulk, and that's what a lot of people... It's the same reason people got annoyed with the most recent Godzilla movie, where I think he's in it for maybe about... I think his screen time is less than 10 minutes in the whole thing. But that's... But that's the point of the way... I'm referring to Godzilla now. That's the point of the way that character's supposed to work. He's meant to be this big thing that there's build-ups and there's tension before he actually turns up, and he's not overused. And that's the way that they played Hulk in The Incredible Hulk as well. The way he does finally turn up, and then it's like, oh shit, now things are going to happen. And then, you know, explosions and Hulk smash and everything else.
Yeah.
Same with the few moments that we get the Hulk appearing in the first Avengers movie are the moments that when everyone just kind of collectively clenches and tightens up because you know some bad stuff is going to be going down. Mm. And again, as we saw later on, the brilliant sequence with him in Age of Ultron, which we'll get to later, which was just pure fanboy pleasing brilliance.
Yeah.
But
this one, of course, obviously wraps up in its... yes, I am going to do... And this one's post-credit sequence is just as a brilliant bridging thing between each film. So, or...
He's got such a smug smile.
I'm happy. This, and obviously Incredible Hulk's final moment, its post-credit sequence, was Bruce Banner and Tony Stark having a chat in a pub or a bar. Even a pub, it's not Britain, is it? In a bar. And Tony talked about the pickle he'd been in and said,
it's not Bruce Banner, it's General Ross.
Is it?
Yeah.
You've totally fucked that up. It's General Ross. He talks to General Ross, and General Ross says, "Oh, that's a different suit." And Tony Stark basically goes, "Bitch, please." And he says, "I've heard you had a problem." And then he says something about like the Avengers Initiative, or we're assembling a team.
Yes, thanks guys for that, because I was completely wrong. So it's a good job you're here, and I'm not just doing this on my own, shouting into the void, because clearly no one would think I was right. But yes, the Incredible Hulk obviously then leads into the third Marvel film, which is the first sequel of them all, which is Iron Man 2.
If you can make God bleed, people will cease to believe in him.
Yes, this one was bravely taken on by Lathan, because it's divisive, isn't it, to say the least?
It is, but I can't see why all the naysayers are saying things wrong about it, because it's the perfect film in the Marvel canon.
I'll piss off.
He's just doing this to be controversial, isn't he?
Yeah, there's a
at least let him sit near the microphone, Tony. Come on.
It's funny, though. I've actually seen a lot of people like it a lot more in the last few days than I have in years. Literally, the people are like, "That's not as bad as that." You know, it's actually like up there in like the top five. I'm like, "You're fucking kidding, aren't you?" It's an awful
film. Let's not go crazy here.
No, Iron Man 2 is, in terms of our overall narrative of Phase 1, if you compare it to perhaps a TV show season, this is probably the episode, which I say in air quotes, that starts to establish the arc plots that will get carried on for the rest of the season. So a lot of groundwork's done for the Avengers here. So you get introduced, you see a lot more of Nick Fury, you get introduced to Scarlett Johansson's character, but you get that established. I think Coulson appears again, and a lot of elements are laid out in this film, which is, on the one hand, it introduces these characters, so by the time they show up in Avengers, you're familiar with them. On the other hand, it does dilute the film somewhat. So you've got a story of Mickey Rourke's character, as Whiplash, who has a kind of score to settle with the Stark family, and the film kind of loses itself in trying to establish this greater universe. So, and in the process, you've got some interesting ideas of Tony Stark's alcoholism.
Tony Stark. Tony. See that margarine magnate?
Yeah, but don't spread it round.
Anyway, yeah, it kind of loses focus with this. So you've got this idea of the sins of Tony's father coming back to him that he has to deal with, and there's like a scene where he ends up in the suit drunk and basically destroys a nightclub, which probably isn't enough, because I mean, like, it's famous. I think famously that Tony Stark was known for his like alcoholism, and there's like storylines that go into quite depth, and I think that
the Demon in a Bottle, it was called.
Yes, yeah, Demon in a Bottle.
And I think there's quite a lot that was explored with it, and I don't think that's explored quite a lot. Because I remember seeing interviews with, reading interviews with Rob Downey Jr. saying, yes, he's quite looking forward to seeing that aspect of Tony Stark, but you don't really see it. And I'm still quite unsure why they did that. I mean,
there's a lot of things that seem to get cut from what they wanted to do with Iron Man 2, and I don't think anyone's ever really sure why.
I think the best description for it is five pots in search of a film, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit of everything in there.
That is part of the problem, definitely. There's too much going on. There's too many villains.
Yeah, and it's as fun as it probably is to see the S.H.I.E.L.D. and show up and like for Samuel Jackson to basically call, keep turning up and telling Stark he's a moron and then walking out.
That's my Samuel Jackson impression. That's all he ever does when he wanders in the screen. Just turns up and goes,
This is a mini orgasm.
And then leaves again.
I just thought he ate a really good chocolate or something.
Well, you must have heard this story about the first time he ever saw Tom Hiddleston in his Loki outfit when they were on set. I think it was when they were doing the first Avengers. Avengers or something, and Hiddleston comes out and he's in the full Loki outfit with the helmet with the horns on and everything else and bumps into Samuel L. Jackson, and bless him, because he's British, Tom's kind of like, hi Sam, it's just a real pleasure to be working with you today. And Samuel L. Jackson looks up and down and goes, if I'd have known it was fancy dress, I'd have bought my costume.
But do I think it's the worst Marvel film?
Yes.
No.
No.
It's not.
Well, if that's not the worst, which one is?
Thor 2.
For me, it's the second from bottom.
I think it's got a lot of problems, you know, in general. And a lot of people say the same kind of things about this. You know, it does have its defenders. It's one of those films that has, oh, you know, when you see articles that, am I the only one who thinks such and such film is brilliant? And most of the time people are going, yes, you are. And in this case, that's one of them. Because it tries. It has got some really good, I think, aspirations. And that whole storyline of Tony Stark is a really good one. They just don't really get it right. And it suffers from bloated sequel syndrome. But
I've always thought Iron Man 2 was basically an Iron Man movie that just got too much extra stuff added into it, and lots of stuff got cut as a result, like most of Pepper Potts' role in it. What sums it up for me, I don't know if people have tracked this down on YouTube, but after Jon Favreau obviously kind of left the production and was just a bit upset with the whole thing, because much like Edgar Wright seems to have done with Ant-Man, and now it looks like Joss Whedon's going to be doing as well, are just taking a step back because there's so many demands coming in from what that film's got to do to serve all the other films, rather than being able to be its own thing. It just got too much for the whole thing. The original opening sequence, which in the film just has Tony in his Iron Man suit walking silently to the edge of a plane and then jumping out to do the spirally thing to land down in the middle of the Stark conference, but originally had this brilliant Tony and Pepper scene where he's in the suit, you know, throwing up because he's so nervous, and she's trying to get him to get his metal together and then jump out. It's got the moment that we all saw in the trailers where she kisses the helmet and throws it out the plane and he jumps out after it. You complete me! And it's a classic example of how so much got ended up being cut from that film or shuffled around to accommodate other pieces of it, that it's almost like years from now we might get an Iron Man 2 director's cut that gets rid of a lot of that faff and presents all the original footage that was put together for it before it had to be kind of chopped up, before Mickey Rourke's final boss fight got hacked down to about 2 minutes or whatever it ended up being.
But yes, it's there's some good points there in that maybe it was a film that was too, you know, chopped up and everything like that. But it did well at the box office, and of course it queued up the fourth film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe thanks to its post-credit sequence.
Involves Spider-Man. Down
and out.
Batman.
No, because I'm checking to make sure I get this right, okay?
It involves, I'm Batman.
Very simple one. Agent Coulson in the desert finding Thor's hammer, which obviously leads in to Thor.
I have sacrificed much to achieve peace. Thor, through your arrogance and stupidity, you have opened these peaceful realms and innocent lives to the horror and devastation of war.
You are a vain, greedy, cruel boy.
And you are an old man and a fool!
You're unworthy!
Father.
Now take from you your power, and I cast you out!
You're Thor? I'm so Thor I can hardly fit down.
Emma, bring some sense back into proceedings and tell us about Thor.
You want me to bring some sense?
Yeah, this is how far it's gone.
You've seen what you're up against, it shouldn't be too hard.
Thor kind of reminds you a bit like a fairy tale. It's just got like this whimsical magic about it, I think, especially obviously because it's some of it's set in Asgard and things like that. And I think having Kenneth Branagh on board was just, I'm reading that and thinking, seriously, Kenneth Branagh, he's doing Thor. But it kind of had like this almost Shakespearean vibe to it, you know, two brothers feuding over the throne and that kind of thing. And it wasn't too special effects heavy or anything, especially the scenes in Asgard and things like that. And it was enough of an origin story if you didn't know both Thor, but it kind of moved really fast, you know, so you had like, oh, he's going to be king, and then the frost giants come. And Tom Hiddleston was kind of, his performance in it is one of these quiet like background ones that you don't really realize that he's acting the shit out of it, and he's really stealing the movie until after it's finished, and you're like, fucking hell, that Loki guy was good, wasn't he? And do you know when it came out and every all the girls I knew were like, oh my god, Tom Hiddleston's gorgeous, and I was like, are you messing? He's horrible. And now, years later, I'm just like, let's see what
this
you mean.
This is totally going on my Tumblr now.
I was the one gif of him blinking at the camera.
It definitely had this kind of like, yeah, like I said, like almost like the Shakespearean vibe where Loki's like the, I didn't understand his motivation for wanting to be king, except just because I know I can't, I want to be king. That's a bit of a shitty thing to do, isn't it, really, when you think about it? Just like, I'm going to kill our dad, and fuck you, he's loved me for years, but I'm going to fucking kill you so I can have the throne. But what kind of let it down for me a little bit is, I didn't understand why they had to like force this kind of romance storyline between Natalie Portman's character and Thor. I was just like, what? She was there for like 3 days and they're in love and he's like, oh, I'll come back for you and shit like that. I was just like, what the fuck's that about? And his eyebrows are terrible.
In any other movies.
Chris Hemsworth's eyebrows are fucking atrocious in this film. Like, honest to God. Why did they make him bleach his eyebrows? He just looks weird. Looks soulless. It's fucking disturbing.
My question is, did he bleach his nose hair as well? Or do you not notice?
His nose hair, he's a god.
Oh, there you go, then.
It is an interesting one, though, Thor, because it took the first risk in a way, because it took us away from Earth for a fair bit of it, and went and explored, you know, opened up to Asgard and the Nine Realms. It's interesting because it takes us to different parts of the Marvel Universe, and that was always a bit of a risk, in that were people potentially are going to be okay with the Hulk and Iron Man, but are they going to be okay with an alien race, effectively, even though they look human? Are they going to be okay with all that old mythology and everything like that? And I think, obviously, one of the main reasons is that they cast Chris Hemsworth, who's this Adonis of a man. And importantly, I think the bits where Thor's at its best are when they are taking the piss out of him. And this is why Thor works better when he's not in his own films. Because in the other films, most of the other films anyway that he's in, the Avengers films, he's being mocked quite often. And that's,
he's comic relief, isn't he?
He's comic relief, really. He's the big, long-headed, oh yes, I am a god, and then somebody will, you know, punch him or you know, take the pit. And it works really well because he's so pantomime in that sense that, you know, you can't take him seriously in a way. But when he's headlining it and he has to do the serious stuff, he's less effective. It was the bits in this where he goes, I am the mighty, and then someone injects him with you know, and he's like, That's when this film's really good and really working. The rest of it, at times, it can get a little bit ponderous and a bit silly, potentially.
But again, as I was saying, the point of Iron Man was kind of going, are you okay with the concept of sort of modern-day self-made superheroes? Hulk says, you're okay with the idea of the classic radiation accident superheroes? And then Thor says, are you okay with kind of basically alien superheroes? Because if you are, then cool. That basically covers everything that's going to happen for the next 20 years in our films. And if you're on board with this stuff, you're down for it all, basically. Now we just need to introduce you to a raccoon.
And a talking and a tree.
But that's a fair point, actually. If they hadn't accepted Thor and Asgard, it would have been a lot harder to get people to accept Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, if they'd have done that earlier on, I think it would have turned a lot of people off, because I think people would have been too soon. You know, too weird. Thor was probably one of the ones that was a good way of indoctrinating people into a much bigger universe than just superheroes on Earth, which obviously is something that DC are going to have to be very careful of as they go forward.
Again, that ties into, you know, the villain Thanos and the villains of the Chitauri in the first Avengers, is that without establishing that this kind of stuff is out there through Thor, if we'd suddenly had all these aliens turn up in the fifth movie and we hadn't had any kind of soft introduction to that, it would have felt more incongruous and more kind of out of place with the world that they've been building up.
See, I don't understand to a degree where you're coming from there, because when I go see a superhero film, they can literally throw anything at me and I'll go, yeah, it's a superhero film. It's not supposed to make fucking sense, is it, really? You know,
yeah,
so...
But that's because we're nerds and we're programmed to like and understand this stuff.
Speak for yourself.
I often do.
How dare you say.
These films have to make millions upon billions of dollars at the box office, and to do that, they can't just appeal to nerds. It's why a lot of our favourite TV shows have only ever lasted one season, because not enough normal people are watching it.
I was trying to put air quotes
around the word normal there. But it's because now we're in a world where, you know, Avengers t-shirts are being sold in TK Maxx.
You've got to remember as well, in 2011, I mean, it doesn't seem that far away, a lot long ago, but in terms of movies, to an extent it was, in terms of the things that have happened since, you know, Marvel was just really kicking off. It wasn't nearly at the fever pitch it is now, and they still had to be careful about what they did. And Lee's absolutely right in that to get maximum returns and to be able to do what they're doing, they needed to appeal to everybody, and they needed to, you know, if you'd have thrown a little raccoon in a talking tree at people then, without some kind of, you know, gorgeous blonde-headed man, people may not have bought it. So Thor's actually more important a film than people give it credit for. It's certainly not the best one. In fact, when I watched it again not so long back, I didn't like it as much as the first time. But it's an important one. One last thing about Thor, to bear in mind as well, is that it's one of the first films to get a really eclectic, big cast of thespians. So, you know, obviously it's got the new people, like Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston, but it's also got people like Stellan Skarsgård, Callum Fiore, Idris Elba, who's obviously on the rise, and crucially Anthony Hopkins, and he's the first major, you know, mega star, actual genuine great actor, and ever since then Marvel have managed to capture more and more of these really really cool character actors or legendary stars to actually be in their films. So that was possibly the Kenneth Branagh effect.
And let's not forget my homegirl Kat Dennings, you know, while we're talking
your
about
your homegirl, who could forget. And obviously, the final post-credit scene of Thor very much helps to tee up
Spider-Man,
yes, and Black Panther. No,
and Superman,
Man of Steel. No, it tees up the Avengers, obviously, because Stellan Skarsgård ends up with Nick Fury, and they're studying a mysterious cube-shaped object with possibly Loki, you know, in the background doing his trickster thing. So that's an important tee up for later films. But then the next one takes a bit of a swerve off, and this is where we're going to take a slight swerve off briefly, because because the next film in the sequence is Captain America the First Avenger, and this is where Tom East is going to come in. He's going to come in and join the podcast, even though he's not actually with us. So we're going to take a little bit of a break now, where I spoke earlier to Tom about the first Captain America film.
Said that wars are fought with weapons, but they are won by men.
You just don't know when to give up, do you?
I could do this all day.
Our goal is to create the greatest army in history.
I should be going with you. Look, I know you don't think I can do this.
This isn't a back alley, Steve. It's war.
But every army begins with one man.
Five tries in five different cities. I can offer you a chance.
He will be the first in a new breed of super soldiers.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
We couldn't let the Avengers mega special go by without Tom giving a few words about this, because Tom is easily the biggest Captain America fan I've ever met. This had to happen, and unfortunately Tom can't make the special. Why is it Tom, you can't make the special again?
I am going to be in Wales at Wales Comic Con, so I'll still be nerding it up.
Yes.
Yeah. Won't be where you need me to be.
You won't be nerding up with us, which is a good excuse, really. A very good excuse, being nerdy in other locations. But yeah, we couldn't let this go by without talking about Captain America the First Avenger. So, Tom, tell us a bit about it. What's it all about?
The movie doesn't exactly follow kind of comics canon that closely, but there are little bits. I mean, I've gone back and looked at Captain America issue 1, and there's little things you can kind of see reflected in the movie, and like the Cosmic Cube has been in the Captain America mythos for forever, pretty much, and the Red Skull's always been after it. So the movie does quite a good job of kind of reflecting what the core of the comics is and what Cap is in the comics world, which I think is one of the really cool things about the film.
Yeah, as somebody who doesn't read the comics and hasn't read the comics, I have wondered actually how, you know, loyal it is to the backstory, given the fact that the Marvel films themselves the movies have had to maybe adapt themselves to be a certain kind of way in order to make this interconnected universe. So it's interesting that if they were able to balance the traditional Captain America story with the new Marvel universe. Do you think they've managed to do that?
Yeah, I do. I think one of the funny things is in Captain America issue 1, which came out back during, I believe it was actually the 40s, it was perhaps even pre-1941.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, when you see the comic being released in the film, that's genuinely the comic that was released at the time. It was released as kind of like anti-Nazi propaganda in America to kind of bring people together and have them support the war effort.
The film's kind of meta then, I suppose, in that sense, isn't it, in a way? Because it's in-universe a comic about the character, when in reality the actual comic about the character out in the real world was doing the same thing with all the propaganda. That's it. I hadn't thought of that before, actually.
Yeah, it really is. And every time I see the film, I do always have like a little chuckle at that. Because I believe it is the exact same cover. And the cover of Captain America Issue 1 is actually quite famous because it's Cap punching Hitler in the face.
Mm.
So it's obviously an awesome cover.
Yeah.
But one of the things that does make me laugh about Captain America Issue 1 that is very different from the first Avenger is that Cap's origin story is literally 2 pages. They don't go into any kind of background on who Steve Rogers is. It's just like, he was a skinny dude and then he was not. Whereas kind of the first Avenger, it kind of makes you, it makes you fall in love with Steve before he becomes Captain America. You see who he is as a person before he becomes the superhero that we all know.
Right.
You know, we see how courageous he is, and we see his relationship with Bucky, and kind of we like him by the point that he becomes Captain America, so we are invested in his story, whereas the comics never really bothered with that. They were literally just like, this dude is a superhero, and Bucky is a child. So, I mean, it's, the movie's taken it in a very different kind of direction, but I think it actually works a lot better than the original comic did in that sense, because you have that emotional connection to the characters in the film, which took a long time to build up in the comics.
Yeah, and I think that's partly because perhaps of the tone they took with this, in that they made it very much, you know, each Marvel film has had its own kind of style, hasn't it? You know, they've all had their own kind of almost genre, and it's getting even more that way as the films go on. They all kind of fit into either like a space opera, or they're a, you know, a bit of a more of a caper, or they're a darker piece of work, or they're a conspiracy thriller. And this one, this felt very much, you know, adventure serial of the 1930s, Indiana Jones style, derring do, hokum. And I think maybe that factored into why you were able to warm to these characters, because I think there was that light, perhaps that lightness of touch that helped carry the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think it definitely is a, it's obviously a war film as well, but it's kind of a light-hearted kind of approach to it. It's very kind of, there's no real word for it, so let's just call it superhero-y. You know, it's all very majestic, and you really kind of, you're rooting for Cap, and when he does all the fantastic stuff, you're kind of, you believe everything you're seeing, because you're not really questioning it, because you believe that kind of, he is the superhero, and that's just what the world is like. Because the film does such a good job of blending the war with the kind of superhero genre, and it's like an adventure. I will say, one of the things about the film which I'm not annoyed with, but it's slightly disappointing, is that some of the like really exciting stuff, some of the stuff I was definitely looking forward to seeing in the film, which is Cap physically going up against the Nazis and going up against Hydra, is all in a montage in the middle of the film. Like, the Howling Commandos montage, and it's like that could have easily been spread out across the film, and it would have been pretty epic just to see them go up against the enemy in these kind of like really famous battles. And it is kind of like pulled down into a 3-minute montage, which does suck.
It's a cool montage. It is a good montage, but
it's a good montage. I just kind of wish we saw more of it.
Yeah.
But I suppose to make me happy, the film would have to have been like 12 hours long. So that is kind of a shame. But at the same time, you know, I do think that maybe if that montage had been spread out a bit more, we would have gotten to know the rest of the Howling Commandos a bit better. We would have maybe cared about them a bit more, because otherwise they're kind of standing around as extras, and the only people in that group we really know and care about is Cap, and then Bucky. And I did think Bucky kind of got the short end of the stick in this film. He's not really kind of, like, they do push his friendship with Steve, but it's not really, I've never felt it was really solidified by the point that he goes flying off the edge of a train.
I agree, actually, because it was quite a shock. Obviously, most people, you know, people who read the comics would know the general storyline with all that, but to anyone who hadn't, it would have been like, oh my God. But you didn't really feel it as in, oh my God, his best friend is dead. You know, even though if you know your comics, you know he's not. But it was more like an, oh, okay. Oh, you know, yeah, I agree. There was no real emotional power to that, when there perhaps should have been. In fact, there definitely should have been.
Yeah, I think, I hasten to call it a problem, but I'd say, but one of kind of the reasons that happened is because the film spends so much time setting up the relationship between Steve and Peggy Carter,
yeah,
that kind of Steve's friendship with Bucky kind of gets the short shift, because you understand the connection between Steve and Peggy a lot more than you do between Steve and Bucky, because by that point, Steve and Bucky have had maybe one or two scenes together, whereas Steve and Peggy have had at least five or six. So you understand their connection better. So if it had been Peggy that had been blown out of the train, I think audiences would have felt it a lot more, because there had been that emphasis on them that wasn't there on Bucky.
Yeah, yeah.
It swings and roundabouts, I mean, so... Like, obviously Bucky kind of, there's more later on, but I think in the context of this film, Bucky does feel a bit short-handed, especially when he's such an important character in the original Captain America run. So,
but I think that's a consequence as well of Marvel not only thinking in terms of, you know, the overall cinematic universe up until now, but later, you know, they probably knew back then that the second film was going to deal with, well, A, it was getting Cap to the future, which again means that they have to sacrifice, you know, more time with the Howling Commandos and more time in the war. You know, if they'd have done three Captain America films set in the 40s, then you would have had all that. You know, to get him to the future, they have to go through all that quickly, for better or worse. And the same with Bucky. They knew more than likely that the Winter Soldier was going to be the second story for Cap. And it is the logical story in the future. But you have to rush these things, unfortunately, to get to where you need to be, which is... Even though it's a really fun film, and I'm a big fan of this one, I think it's one of the best ones. They had to rush certain things, I think, yes, in order to get to where they wanted to be. And I think you've hit the nail on the head with it being the more the romance is the more central element. Do you think that Chris Evans and Hayley Atwell have good chemistry? Do you think the cast overall is a strong one here?
I think the cast in this film is pretty damn awesome. I think Chris Evans is. Very underrated as an actor as it is, but he's completely believable as Steve Rogers in the same way that Hayley Atwell is as Peggy Carter, to the point that Marvel have had to like make a short movie of them, make a TV show for Hayley Atwell, because there has been audiences have connected to her portrayal of Peggy so much. In the original comic book, she is a minor character at best. She's referenced like once or twice by Sharon. She only makes a couple of appearances. And yet, it's because of Hayley Atwell's portrayal of her that Peggy Carter has gone on to become kind of one of the big faces of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I mean, I would say she's easily up there with Black Widow, because she's the first kind of female character to have her own kind of fronted projects in Marvel Cinematic Universe.
She's a fan favourite for sure.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So I think, and this film has kind of built Steve and Peggy up to have these huge kind of fan bases, and because of Chris Evans and Hayley Atwell, like, giving so much to the roles, it really works. Again, the cast for the Howling Commandos, they're all really great actors, and it was nice seeing some of them back for Agent Carter. So I do wish we got to see a bit more of them in the film. I think if, say, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, if all of the movies were, say, mini-series of 12 episodes like they're doing with Daredevil, I think maybe this film maybe would have worked better as a mini-series, because you would have had that time to get to know everyone, to the point where in The Avengers you physically would have felt Cap's loss of the past, like the fact that you'd never see all of his friends and Peggy again, because you would have connected to those characters at a point where, bam, suddenly they're gone, it's a brave new world and stuff. Whereas kind of going on from this, like, you can understand why Steve's sad, but because you've never spent that much time with those characters, you're not personally kind of invested in them. So I think, I don't know, maybe it's just me wanting my 12-hour Captain America movie. Who knows?
But no, it's a trade-off. It is a trade-off. I think it's a good point, because the longer series are going, you know, by default are naturally going to, you know, connect more with the characters and give you more to chew on with that. No, I think it's a very good point. This is the trade-off Marvel have to do in order to get characters to a certain point, which is why their best films, I think, are the ones that really do make you feel things. And they make you care, even in their short running time. And they have that spirit and that, you know, that sense of fun. And I think the reason this is a good film as well is that has that too. That has that combination of the fact that you do like and care about these people, even if we don't know them that well, but you also enjoy the ride. And it's a fun ride. And as we've said, manages to blend not just an adventure serial kind of gung-ho kind of thing, but also a war movie, which is a tricky balance to pull off, you know.
Yeah, I definitely think you're right, though. It really does kind of combine the fun with the sadness.
Mm. Well, thanks for popping in and talking about Cap.
Yep, thank you for having me, and enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Thank you very much. At the end of Captain America, obviously, Nick Fury approaches Steve Rogers when he's been thawed out, and asks him to join, and this is thawed out. Yes, I'm waiting for that. And then that's it, we're away, and it's the big one. It's Marvel's Avengers Assemble.
War has started. And we are hopelessly outgunned.
Director Fury, I think it's time.
You here with a mission, sir? Trying to get me back in the world?
Trying to save it.
Doctor, we need you to come in.
What if I say no?
I'll persuade you.
What are you asking me to do? It's called the Avengers Initiative.
All of these together.
Oh my god. Please, infusion of 80s pop again.
or the Avengers, depending on where you are. And obviously it wasn't called The Avengers in England because of the fact we have The Avengers from the 60s, so they changed it in England. But
a decision made entirely by the board of film board, who remembered this and thought that kids who, you know, are 50 years removed from this thing might get a bit confused about something that they probably never have heard of.
Actually, saying that, I was really just slapped on Steve in the show getting able to
try. I guess that shows how out of touch the BBFC are.
I thought you were going to say Leiden.
Well, obviously.
Emma, you're going to lead on talking about Avengers, which, I mean, I will just say quickly, I think it's still the best one of them all, but... Yeah, tell us about it.
Do you know how, like, I've been talking about Age of Ultron for, like, a year? Mm. Well, I was about 10 times worse in the lead-up to Avengers. I remember I worked in the cinema when this was on and went to the opening night with my mum, and literally when it started, I grabbed my mum's hand and my eyes filled up. That's how important this film was to me, seeing all these, not just... from the movies, but I've liked comics for quite a few years, and I remember watching, you know, the Iron Man cartoons and things like that. So this was really important to me, and to see it all finally come together was something I never thought would happen, and it was really quite emotional. That sounds super sad, but I'm not going to apologise for it. The first bit when you've got Cap and Iron Man and Thor and Loki, I was just like, I just can't believe this is happening. There's so much action in it, and you've got your storyline of, like, you know, Loki's coming to basically, we need someone to rule us because we're all knobheads and stuff like that. And so it's like, no, you're not. And it's the team coming together, and you've got the introduction of Hulk. And it's literally the entire plot. You've got Hawkeye coming into it and stuff like that. I like the way Hawkeye went off to do his own little thing with Loki, because we hadn't really seen him before except for a little bit in Thor. So everyone was kind of integral into moving the story along, to have Joss Whedon direct and write it, I mean, it's just the icing on the cake, isn't it, really? Who else could have done it justice?
I remember a tweet that someone retweeted when it came out. The tweet said something, we've done it, people, we've managed to converge both universes where Joss Whedon is critically acclaimed and successful at once. So great. Yes. And it's very weird. But it's a very weird scenario.
But that's true, though, because he's somebody... I mean, you know, I will say this. Before the Avengers, it was before, actually, I'd watched Buffy or Angel as well. And I thought he was good, but I didn't quite get the hype with Joss Whedon. And then when I watched the Avengers, and I was just absolutely blown away by it, considering that I didn't particularly think much of the trailer, strangely enough, and I was like, oh, this might be all right. And I just went in there and I thought it was phenomenal. And I came out and I just was like, I want to see it straight away again.
That yeah, that's
the point with Joss Whedon that I realised how great he was, what you guys had been saying for years. And it was so nice to see somebody who has been critically acclaimed and who's fucking suffered for his art yeah. over the years, you mm-hmm. know, all the shit he's been thrown at him, to finally make a film that has grossed $1.5 billion and is the third highest grossing film ever, only beaten by Titanic and Avatar. So
both shit.
Right.
And so, we all know really, the whole kind of 3D ticket inflation prices thing argument exactly. that we could have about those films.
It's the third highest grossing film, and it's easily the best critically acclaimed film of all time, if you look at it from that perspective, that's made that amount of money. So
it had the right amount of humour. Like I said, I went to see it the first opening night, and when Hulk punched Thor and the whole puny god thing, like, it was just so, it could have been so bad and so camp, but it was so well done. And the moment that my favourite moment from that film is when they're in New York and Mark Ruffalo's just showed up and gone, "Oh, that's my secret, I'm always angry," and fucking smashed the big thing on its head.
Oh god,
and they're all
so
standing
satisfying.
In a circle and they're all like, you know, suiting up, and Cat flips his shield and Thor gets his hammer, and I was just like, oh my god, this is amazing. I think I'm gonna cry. And I think I probably did cry.
Everyone was like cheering and screaming in the cinema, though. I'm sure for all our showings, when those things were happening, Thor, you know, Hulk punches Thor and Hulk punches the, you know, the thing, and like you say, the pan round shot of them all, everyone was just like, "Woo!" Because it was just that kind of iconic. This is why I think it's it's a cliche term, but I think it is the Star Wars of our generation in this sense. That film.
Yeah. Do you know what that pan round? Reminded me of, do you know that scene in No Serenity when River's in the bar and the music and the advert comes on and she like flips and she starts like kicking everyone's off, and you were like, "I've been waiting for this." That's what that pan round shot reminded me of too much. Like, they've been building up for so long, and that's what it really reminded. Like, finally it happened, you know, and it was only a short little thing, but.
And it works, and that's the crucial thing. When it could have been a massive clusterfuck, it works.
It also works as well. I mean.
The Josh Boy.
What is wrong with you tonight?
Secret name when you're on the webcam.
Is he joining Rodney Downey Jr. and Tony Stark?
I'm liking this pocket universe that Latham inhabits.
In the Among Us. Latham's got his own little Marvel pocket universe of names and characters.
No, I was going to say,
that's a full size universe for Latham.
Ticks all the boxes, but in terms of the technical writing level as well, it closes off this first phase very well. It acts as a season finale, and being a fan of shows which has quite a few Joss Whedon season finales, it works very similar to Buffy especially. And then it kind of closes off quite a few plot lines, character arcs that open up in their films, with perhaps the exception of Thor, who's a bit underserved. Admittedly, in this one, they have like considerable elements of closure. I mean, Tony gets his self-sacrificing moment, and it's probably his greatest moment of heroism in the whole series so far. That you haven't really seen him doing anything else.
I'm so glad you mentioned the season finale comment. Was it you that tweeted it? I think, that's where Joss brings his experience from television to the table.
Yeah, I mean, and. Captain America has his own has his climatisation moment as well. He also part of one of my favourite moments in the film, where he goes, "Wizard of Oz," another reference.
He looks a proud of himself as well.
Nice.
Yeah. There's quite a few little moments where all Whedonism sort of littered areas.
Yeah.
Batman's playing Gallagher.
What's also funny is that Joss Whedon's always said that he struggled to write Captain America because he struggles with kind of the Boy Scout character. I think he does quite well. But he's got a lot of experience with flawed heroes, and
I think it's working on two levels with the character as well, is that there's the outward sort of swaggery. It's like that Gallagher moment that I just mentioned, that Tony basically is just acting around like a buffoon so that no one notices him kind of slipping bugs and trackers and things all over the bridge of the carrier. It's that kind of having characters who are operating on two levels, but you're only really maybe aware of one of them at any given moment.
Tony Stark's like a big kid in this, though. He's like my son. just, you know, poking around, see what, like, how far you can push it. Like, the scene in the lab with Bruce Banner, and he's, like, so desperate to get him to turn into the Hulk. Like, he's like, oh, I'm a big fan of your work, and I like it when you turn into a enormous Green Rage monster. And he keeps, like, poking him and stuff. Like, it's like, and, like, you watch it and go, oh, you knobhead, that's not going to end well. But Tony Stark's just like, tee-hee, poke, poke, poke. Want to see the Hulk. Hello? What are you doing? No, we're not finished.
Special guest.
What does he think of the Avengers?
What do you think of the Avengers, Freddy? Do you like the Avengers? Are they good or are they bad? Okay. Who's your favourite Avenger? The Hulk. It's a good choice.
Yeah.
Come give me a kiss. Come Woo! Here. Come give me a kiss. I'm here. Give me a kiss. Stop being stingy. Come give your mother a curse. Come on. I love you. Sorry.
That was completely adorable.
That was staying in, Emma. Sorry, some of that.
Yes.
I've got this image that there's like a cupboard in Joss Whedon's house, labeled stuff that I really want Tony Stark to say on screen but couldn't fit in. Mm. And he's just basically got a load of dialogue that he just had to write but couldn't put in anywhere.
But I think the thing with the difference with this, and I think one of the reasons it works so well, is the fact that there is a definite distinction between the dialogue in the previous films and in this film.
Yeah.
You know, you can tell this has the Joss Whedon sheen on it, the Joss Whedon wit, that sense of, you know, almost meta winking knowing, you know, about all the conventions and things like that. And it's why it punches up to a different level. One of the things that I've found really, really strange lately is when I've spoken to several people, admittedly people who aren't massive like fans of Marvel and movie fans, who've seen the Avengers, and they've not liked it. And this is the reason why. It's because it's all just them talking and then there's not much action in it. Now, if anything, one of the reasons
which film
I didn't
are they
like
watching?
Age of Ultron as much is because of the opposite, right? Now, for me, and we'll get to that later, but I can't understand people who seem to think the Avengers... I mean, do they not understand that you could have a whole film of people talking in Joss Whedon language?
And it would still be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it baffles me. It baffles me. And it's not true either. It's actually not true that there's no plot.
The same criticism was given to the Social Network at some point. They're saying it's just a bunch of people talking about stuff, but it's Aaron Sorkin.
Exactly, they're missing the point. These great wordsmiths.
Yeah. 90% of the films are just a bunch of people talking about stuff.
We've kind of already mentioned it, but the thing that makes Avengers so great and the Marvel films themselves as a whole is the human element of it. It is the quieter moments that make it so good, and that's why, you know, Man of Steel is never going to be close to those films, is because it's Man of Steel is all just throwing people through buildings, which is great to watch for, you know, a few minutes, but you can't watch that film in, film out. There's got to be those small moments where you get intimacy between the characters and great dialogue and ultimately interesting characters themselves. Otherwise, you might as well just go and watch an action film.
That's precisely... Yeah, exactly. That was my point I was making earlier about the new Godzilla movie that tries to do much the same thing. Okay, the characters and writing aren't as good or as interesting as they could have been, but by kind of having these longer build-ups between the sort of the release of the actual big monster smackdowns, even though it's only fleeting moments of it, when these things do happen, it kind of... It's your release of tension.
And even the dialogue scenes had a pace about them. They weren't just sort of sitting around in a room just talking to each other about the weather for half an hour.
Exactly. Exactly.
They were driving the story forward.
I think the only scene where they're sitting down is Black Widow and Hawkeye in the like medical room. I think that's the only scene where they're sitting talking.
Mm. Yeah, you know, and that's why, one of the reasons it's such a great film, and it was great to see the first phase of the Marvel plan climax in such an epic way. And you know, the next film along the list, after obviously the pre-credit sequence very much teases up the overarching, you know, big villain of Thanos, even though we don't really, he's not named and we don't necessarily hear him talk,
and the bit where they're just sitting down eating
shawarma. Well, we have the shawarma bit at the end, which is a very good scene. It obviously bleeds into what right now is the last Iron Man film, Iron Man 3.
Got a lot of apologies to make. Nothing's been the same since New York. You experience things, and then they're over. I can't sleep.
And when I do, I have nightmares. Honestly, there's 100 people who want to kill me. I hope I can protect the one thing I can't live without.
Emma, you took the lead on this one again. The third and final Iron Man film. Let's hear about it.
It's like someone mentioned before, it's kind of like almost an end to Tony Stark's story where he's dealing with his past mistake of basically ignoring Aldrich Killian. The first sequence is them in like 2000 and he's talking to that woman who's not a botanist about the whole Extremis program and things like that. But he's also kind of suffering with like post-traumatic stress disorder. Like, he's built this whole, like, Iron Army almost to protect himself because he's having flashbacks of the wormhole at the end of Avengers, and he can't sleep, and it's kind of like, it was nice to see Tony Stark deal with this vulnerability that he now felt after the events of Avengers. So it kind of humanized him a little bit, because he's such an arrogant bastard, like, in every film, like, I'm better than all of yous. It was nice to see that side of him, and it was also nice to see him have to deal with the consequences of what he, like, his, almost his past life. I'm not sure how I feel about this film, to be honest. Like, there's times when I really love it, and then there's other times when I think, oh, it's all right, but that's about it. So, and I think quite a lot of people, from my experience, don't like it. And it's not that I don't like it, it's just, it's obviously much better than Iron Man 2, but that's not really hard. But, I mean, there are really, like, the scene where he's being captured, and it's, he knows his suit's coming for him, and he's like, oh, you're going to be sorry in, like, 5 seconds, and he's counting down, he's going, I'll give you 10 more. And at the very end, I mean, I didn't particularly like the scene where Pepper saved the day. What the fuck was that about?
Jump the shark moment, wasn't it, for that character? I liked
the moment when Pepper turns up and saves him. I do not like the moment immediately afterwards where he just offhandedly says, oh, but then I sort of made it better and she was fine, so that's okay again.
Yeah,
it's like, it's no, okay. Why don't we keep having her awesome superpowers? Because that would be brilliant. But maybe it was just me.
I like the whole, when he's talking about, he's got his version of the clean slate. Remember we were talking about this in the Fast and Furious podcast about how there's this clean slate will erase your criminal record, but his clean slate thing was like getting rid of the Iron Man costumes, and he like finally he's able to take the shrapnel out of his heart, so he's not really Iron Man anymore, and he's like, I don't really need these suits, and it's kind of him coming to terms with who he is and who he wants to be and all that kind of thing,
realizing it's not all on him anymore.
Yeah, I like the fact that the story kind of answered why the Avengers went there, like it just happened so fast, and he kind of said, oh, they're all off doing their own thing and I've got to do this on my own. But It could have been, if I hadn't seen An Age of Ultron, I wouldn't have been surprised, because I felt like that was a good enough ending for the character that it wouldn't have bothered me.
I think any film that starts with I'm blue, double D, double die, that song is ultimately going in as a winner. because that is just the ultimate song of the end of the 90s. So, but for me, Iron Man 3 definitely was a step up from Iron Man 2. And I don't know if it's as good as the first Iron Man, but for me, I have a lot more love for it than I think other people do. There are moments where I'm a bit like, oh, did you have to do that? And, you know, Pepper Potts suddenly becoming Super Pepper was, you know...
It's just like a compliment. A bit.
Next to Super Salt. As you said, it was kind of a jump the shark moment, I think, for her. But ultimately, you knew it was going to happen. As soon as she falls into the pit of fire, you knew she wasn't dead, and you kind of knew where we've seen people walk through fire already, so in that film, so we kind of knew she was going to be okay. Saving Tony, I don't know, because ultimately he should be the superhero of that film, but overall I really liked it. I know people weren't a fan of the fact that the Mandarin wasn't really the Mandarin.
I love that. I do as well.
That's
an amazing twist. Yeah. I love that.
I agree.
I'm glad everyone agrees. I love that twist. I thought it was brilliant. And Ben Kingsley plays it so brilliantly.
Yeah.
Ben Kingsley in that moment, you know, when he's like the real, like, what's his name?
Trevor Slattery.
Trevor Slattery, yeah.
He reminds me so much of my friend Ben when he's drunk.
Like, that you kind are of actually friends with Ben Kingsley.
Yeah.
The beauty of that scene, obviously, and that moment, is the fact that everyone expects to cast Ben Kingsley as this scary sort of, you know, serious, I am very important villain. And then the wonderful thing of him just being a pissed up Cockney actor, it's brilliant. Well, it's really clever.
What I find quite interesting about it, though, is that it's because the traditional origin of the Mandarin I'm not 100% sure on if, whether he's actually an alien or not.
I don't think so. I think he is just like a foreign terrorist kind of dude. I'll check. There may have been more than one version of the character.
He's inherited magic alien rings. I think that's his source of his power. But I think he is just like a Chinese supervillain.
Yeah, I think so.
He just didn't moisturise that day away from OK.
Yeah, I suspect that the whole thing with the Mandarin and this Ben Kingsley twist is because of the creative influences behind this, and it's one of those things where they won out over Marvel. I mean, Shane Black was the director of this, and Shane Black's the genius behind Lethal Weapon, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. He's one of the great underappreciated writer-directors of Hollywood in the last, like, 30 years. And I was really excited when he was announced as director for this, when Jon Favreau decided not to do it again.
And the writer.
This kind of twist, I suspect, is Shane Black saying, well, why don't we do this? And then, because for Marvel didn't have necessarily a grand plan for the Mandarin like they do with other villains and other things, that's when they went, okay, and then he won that out. And that's why I think that's one of the reasons I really like Iron Man 3, because I think it does have an element of the director behind it, more so than some of the other films do.
You see, that's the point I was going to make, is that this is probably the second film after The Avengers to have a sort of auteur writer-director behind it. And you get it again later on in Guardians with James Gunn doing again pretty much the same sort of thing, imposing their style on it. While before, with in-house writers directors, it didn't have quite the same ballsiness almost.
Yeah,
and not all it's of why Edgar works. Wright's Ant-Man would have been so great.
Not all of this works, you know. It's got the plot's a bit all over the place. Guy Pearce, he's always good, but his villain doesn't really work. You know, it's not perfect, but it's you know, it's got a lot more going for it than the second one. And did you guys know it made 1.2 billion?
Yeah, it was massive.
Yeah,
it was really?
Massive. Yeah.
Wow. Monstrous.
Sixth highest grossing film of all time. Now, I didn't know it did that well. So.
It's riding the crest of the Avengers plus Robert Downey Jr., wasn't it?
Yeah. The reason I kind of brought up the Mandarin twist was because I at the time when that one came out, I had a lot of comic book fans, as it were, working on the team, and they didn't like that. They said that, oh, the Mandarin's this great villain and he's going to be completely wasted, and it's such a shame. But I guess from a more casual perspective, someone that loves the MCU but doesn't necessarily read the comics, I thought it was a brilliant twist, and so I'm glad you guys kind of agree. And it doesn't necessarily mean they can't bring the Mandarin back, because ultimately, it's just a title. It's just a name.
Yeah.
There's no reason why someone can't take on that mantle, or whether Ben Kingsley's character was actually fooling everybody.
Have you seen the mini sort of sequel to the Trevor saga, which was, I believe, on four Blu-ray, which continues the story of Trevor in prison,
it brings
the Ten Rings back into play. It's a terrific little video if you can find it. It's Ben Kingsley basically playing exactly the same role again with exactly the same amount of gusto. And then it sort of retcons a little bit the idea of a Mandarin. So it might sort of satisfy the diehard comic purists a little bit more.
And as I said, it's possible that I guess it's less so because we saw him, you know, being arrested and still doing the oh la di da, yes, kind of act. But, you know, had that all been for Stark, had we not seen him do it, you know, in front of other people, then there was always that that possibility that actually he was acting, you know, he was an actor within an actor. But it's still a possibility, and I still think the Mandarin's an interesting character, and just getting Ben Kingsley back to do anything would be great.
Good call. But of course, you know, the success of this, this rampant success, wasn't quite necessarily repeated for the next one, Thor the Dark World.
After all this time, now you come to visit me, brother. Why? To mock. I need your help. But I wish I could trust you. If you did, you'd be the fool I always took you for.
This one potentially had its detractors too, didn't it, Lathan?
I don't see why. I think it's the best film
of
the whole
MCU.
Oh my god!
I'm so glad he's sitting by me and I can see how facetious he's being.
I can't work under these conditions, I swear.
I mean, come on. Can you name me one moment in Avengers Assemble that's better than the sight of Thor on the tube? Can you name me one...
can you name your whole... You're just trying to wind me up.
yeah, and the next question is, can you actually name me what the flipping hell the villain's name is? Because I can't flipping remember.
Malkeith.
It's Christopher Eccleston.
In a funny mask.
I'm gonna...
It's Christopher Eccleston dressed up as one of the goblins from Nightmare.
Now, Four in Nightmare would be a brilliant concept for a film, wouldn't it?
I believe it's Malekith.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Yeah,
that's right.
Malachi. Now, what did you really think, Layton?
I thought it was the best film in the
world. You've broken his sarcasm meter, I think, haven't you?
I think maybe Latham's forfeited his abilities to do a review on it now. We should move on to the next one.
I think that's about all we need to talk about for Dark Bell, really. We've covered it in detail.
To be fair, I'll say what it does have is that it has Kat Dennings in it.
Always a bonus.
Chris O'Dowd in it.
A lot of the ideas in it are actually quite interesting. I think, especially Phase 2 Marvel films, have always had the... criticism that, oh no, the final set piece is a big massive rock slash helicopter smash into earth. In terms of Phase 2, I mean, the actual set piece, the idea is actually quite unique and interesting, where you've got like them travelling through different worlds at once, so like you're like Phrase Hammer and it goes onto an alien planet and then back to London. The idea is good, the execution not so good. I mean, how long's the running time?
They're probably got about 2 hours, aren't they?
112 minutes.
There you go.
It feels like an 80-minute film because it just doesn't feel like it's got a lot in it.
It suffers from the same issue that Iron Man 2 had, in that there's a lot of good stuff that ended up being cut from the film that would have helped clear bits of it up, like the whole the switch over the Loki Odin bit at the end that just kind of happens. But as I understand it, actually had some scenes that set that up a little bit better, so that it made sense what had actually gone on, rather than it just ending on this massive twist and leaving you going, hang on, what? How did what happened now?
I like Loki in The Avengers. I think he was perhaps a bit more shoehorned into this than he perhaps should have been. And at one point, I actually thought, I mean, there's the whole fake out of whether they actually killed him off, and part of me was like, actually, you know, this film might be a lot better if they just let him be. And then decide to try and go into some new avenues, like, or just start focusing on new villains to explore in the future. I actually kind of said, "Oh, fuck off!" quite loudly when he appeared at the end.
Were you in the cinema?
Yes, we got ejected from the cinema, as I remember.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. How many whiskies have you had at that point, Leighton?
Oh, at least 20.
None, which strangely enough, but
Fireball.
Yeah.
We're putting him in his Diet Coke when he wasn't looking.
Yeah. It just seems like, I mean, like a lot. I think a lot of the actual plot and Christopher Eccleston in a very
who?
Crystal Eccleston.
Christopher.
You said Crystal.
He said Crystal.
Crystal Eccleston.
That's Christopher Eccleston.
Crystal Ecclecake. Where Crystal Eccles Cake's villain.
What a strip bars of a North, you know.
Among Us.
Oh, God, I'm so glad we don't have a script, because otherwise we wouldn't have all these beautiful moments.
Yeah.
With Rodney Downey Jr.
Rodney Downey Jr.
versus Crystal Eccles Cake.
Crystal
Methstone. In the Among Us. In the Among Us. Yeah, there's. I mean, it's out of all the villains we've had, I mean, again, one of the recurring criticisms about the Marvel films is that a lot of the villains aren't well defined, and the only real example that stands out is Loki. And I think it was good in Thor, it was really good in Avengers. Having him as like a nuisance in this one, it just didn't feel right.
But you definitely got a point though, Leighton, that the fact is that I remember back along when, before this film was released, that they did say that Loki had been added to in this film, that he wasn't quite as big a part as he ended up becoming, and I think in turn that meant that Malekith didn't get developed quite as much as maybe he should have done. And in the end, you've got Christopher Eccleston got completely wasted.
he's brilliant, isn't he? Like, capable of probably stealing scenes, but someone says, "Oh, we need more Tom Hiddleston. We need more Tom Hiddleston. We want more Loki. One more Loki."
That's the fat girl.
Age of Ultron.
The Dark World is probably the only Marvel film I can think of, even incorporating Incredible Iron Man 2, that is forgettable in a way.
Yeah, the thing is, you don't need to go, "We need to add in more Tom Hiddleston." You put the nail on the head where you said he can steal scenes. he can steal a scene with what he was already given. He doesn't need to have an expanded...
Weren't those extra scenes written by Joss Whedon? The extra Hiddleston scenes?
I don't know.
I seem to remember that being the case.
Yeah, it possibly might have been, but... And actually, you might be right. But the point is, they didn't need to do that.
It took away from Eccleston, didn't it? It took away from the poet Malachi having Hiddleston pop up, because it's like, we've got another villain here.
Well, it's like we were, at one point we were on Earth, we were with Malachi, and then we were also in Asgard, but they're also in Asgard prison with Loki, and so you're in too many places at once. And again, it's the criticism of Iron Man 2, is that there's just too much going on that then saturated everything.
And this, I don't think there's enough going on.
Yeah, this is the one that he's below Iron Man 2 for me.
It was probably the lowest point of Phase 2, really. But then it led into a film which really did get people back on side, which was the second Captain America film, Captain America the Winter Soldier.
Coming up on the drop zone, Cap.
You do anything fun Saturday night?
Well, all the guys in my barbershop quartet are dead, so... No, not really.
You know, if you ask Kristen out from statistics, she'd probably say yes.
That's why I don't ask.
Too shy or too scared?
Too busy! Was he wearing a parachute?
No. No, he wasn't.
The Winter Soldier, it was possibly Marvel getting back on form.
Yeah, for me, this possibly is the highlight. And it's quite difficult because I flip the kind of, for my top three, around quite a lot. But this definitely goes in there. Which was surprising for me, because as I said earlier, First Avenger, particularly on first watch, wasn't my favourite. But with this, they completely changed, well, literally, they completely changed the whole backdrop of the Marvel Universe by annihilating everything that we knew about S.H.I.E.L.D. and reintroducing Hydra again to the wider universe, and the kind of the effects it had on everything, even the TV series Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., meant that it had a lasting effect on what was to come. And it was done so well, because I felt what maybe First Avenger didn't do was that it had something to say, and something to say about our society, and it had that human element that human
That's what was missing.
I'm seeing
that's what was missing.
Robbie Downey Jr.
riding it. He rode in on it.
Yeah, with Robert Rodriguez, who I've called in before.
Robert Rodriguez.
Do you remember that when I was talking about All Is Lost?
Yeah.
Robert Rodriguez. But yeah, it brought back the hue. I was going to say elephant now.
Try state element again. Without thinking this, you won't be able to.
No, I can only think of elephant. It brings back the humanity to Captain America, because obviously he's been this.
The huge manatee. We've got manatees, we've got elephants, we've got all sorts now. We've got a stork hanging around somewhere. We'll have Peter Porker, the spectacular spider ham, showing up in a minute.
What it does so well is it brings back the human element to Captain America's character, because obviously he lost that in a way, becoming this super soldier, and he's, for the first time, he's got this difficult decision to make, where he's got his best friend in the world, Bucky Barnes, is ultimately his biggest enemy in this. In fact, he's not the biggest enemy at all. You've got Robert Redford's character, whose name goes out of my head.
Pierce.
Alexander Pierce, yeah, and the whole Hydra operation, which has consumed S.H.I.E.L.D., that it almost becomes a slight byproduct. There's a small conversation on the bridge between Anthony Mackie and Chris Evans, where they're talking about the fact that Bucky will be at this final showdown, which we all know, having watched all these Marvel films so far, that this big showdown will happen, and it will be massive, and there'll be guns, and there'll be flying off planes and all sorts, and it's a brilliant spectacle. But ultimately it's brought back right at the end to this relationship between these two characters that one character doesn't even realise they've got, and Captain America, Steve Rogers, has this difficult battle that he's got to save the day, but he also wants to save his friend. And that's what I think is so great about Winter Soldier.
It felt like a spy movie, like a Bourne film.
Yes.
Did anyone else think that element of it?
Yeah. And the politics as well in it.
It was taking a riff on the 70s conspiracy thriller story. So things like 3 Days of the Condor and the Parallax View and those kind of movies that were very sort of you know, paranoid in a certain sense, and that's one of the reasons that Robert Redford was cast, because he did all the President's Men, you know, and he, it's one of those little knowing, oh, okay, kind of castings, and you know that it, they got that tone and blended it with a futuristic sense really well. I have to say as well, this is my favourite score of all of them by Henry Jackman. It's brilliant, the score for this, and it really helps pulse the movie along. It is, as Emma says, it's like a Bourne movie spliced with a 70s conspiracy thriller with superheroes, and to me that's just my perfect film.
There's a lot to like about this one.
It's so good, this one. It really is.
It's the relationship between Steve and Natasha as well really sells this one. The moment that I keep seeing people referencing back, going to, it's the bit just after they've stolen the car and they're driving along in it, and Natasha's sitting there with her feet up on the dashboard. She says something about Steve, like, teasing him, saying, oh, now you've stolen a car, and without looking at him, he just says, borrowed, and take your feet off the dashboard. And as she just takes her feet back down again, there's this moment where she just gives him this little bit of a grin, and it's almost like you can sense that all of a sudden she kind of realises that, as incorruptible as he is, she gains, like, a ton of respect for him in that moment. And you can tell that these are two people who are going to work brilliantly together, because they're just never going to screw each other over or mess each other around, but they are going to work really well as a team, because they've got this element of, you know, affection and respect for one another, same as she has with Hawkeye, and then ultimately as she ends up having with Banner as well.
I think that combination of Cap and Widow powers Winter Soldier above the First Avenger, because he's got someone, like I said earlier, to play off. Someone who's a slightly different ideology, and it brings out more of the capitude in Cap.
I
did indeed say capitude.
That's quite good. I like that.
I think Romanov, a Black Widow, already had her following, but this film took it to a new level that actually a lot of people, including myself, went into Age of Ultron purely just to watch her. And there's a lot of people, we'll go on to it later, that obviously hate that relationship with Hulk, but it's sold because of how well built her character has become.
I think it's a very strong entry for Phase 2, and I think it really shifts the whole gears of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But then, interestingly enough, and probably wisely, for the second to last film we're going to talk about, it completely switches things up to a completely different level and gives us Guardians of the Galaxy.
We arrested these five on Xandar. Check out the rap sheets.
Drax, a.k.a. the Destroyer. Since his wife and family were killed, he's been on a rampage across the galaxy in his search for vengeance. Gamora, soldier, assassin, wanted on over a dozen counts of murder. Rocket, wanted on over 50 charges of vehicular theft and escape from lockup.
What the hell?
Groot, he's been traveling recently as Rocket's personal houseplant / muscle.
Peter Jason Quill. He's also known as Star-Lord.
Who calls him that?
Himself, mostly. He's wanted largely on charges of minor assault, public intoxication, and fraud.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm really torn as to whether this or Avengers Assemble is the best film of Marvel. It's one of them. Pete, what are you reading?
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much my thoughts, exactly. I think on a good day, Guardians can actually eclipse even Avengers, because this came in, it was the wildest possible idea. Basically doing what Avengers took five films to do, get an entire new team together, a team of scumbags and killers, really, throw it into a sci-fi world which hasn't really been touched on before, and incorporate a CGI raccoon and a tree. Which, it sounds like it could have been a complete clusterfuck of a cauldron of mess, but it actually turned out through the lens of James Gunn, who was the auteur, writer, director of it, to become an incredible entry in the series, mainly because he just gave us a great big elevation of wit, heart, and gusto. I mean, just the attitude of it, and not least helped by the incredible soundtrack as well. If you say Captain America the best score, I think it's challenged for me by the soundtrack of Guardians, which is... The awesome mix itself has been on repeat on my head and on my iPod for the last year. So, 70s rock soundtrack.
That soundtrack also has a kind of plot element that works quite well into it.
Yes, it's
an emotional crew.
Every song sort of links into what's going on in the narrative at that moment, or at least on some level, which I think is a brilliant idea, particularly towards the end. It's not perfect. I mean, I think Lee Pace is quite bland as the main villain of the piece. There's a bit too much space battle-y stuff at the end, which gets a bit lost in mush.
A film called Guardians of the Galaxy, yeah, space battles.
Indeed. But I think it's a bit resort of ships flying around and firing at each other, which hampers the pacing a bit. But we're talking minor there. The vast majority of it is getting this core of complete weirdos and misfits, and turning every single one of them into a likable cast, mainly powered by Chris Pratt, coming from pretty much left field at this point to become now one of the biggest film stars of the day, much like Robert Downey Jr. did way back in 2008. By bringing a sort of Han Solo cockiness and humanity to a part, which anchors the film, and then everyone else sort of spins off from that. And Vin Diesel is a talking tree Groot. I mean, there's such so many jokes before about Vin Diesel playing a character made of wood. But he's probably come out as a breakout character of the whole piece, even though he only says five words, I think, aren't there? I am Groot, we are Groot. But somehow he invests so much character into a tree. I actually wonder why he can't invest so much character into himself. But
as I understand it, he made a point of figuring out what Groot was trying to say with every I am Groot through the whole film, so he could do it in a couple of different ways. Didn't he even do his own sort of alternate language versions of the same dialogue as well?
He did every language. So he said Ich bin Groot and Je suis Groot and various other versions of Groot. But
Vin Diesel is one of us, everybody.
Much as Star Wars, which is an easy comparison to make, with R2-D2 and Chewbacca, you could sort of gather what they're saying, even though they're not speaking English. You could sort of get that with Groot by the end, at least I thought so. You knew exactly what he was trying to say.
Guardians is a love letter to kind of late 70s, early 80s sci-fi anyway.
It's a space opera in the Marvel Universe, which is something that had never been done before. It's a massive risk. We were talking earlier about Thor being, you know, taking a risk by going into this fantasy area. I think, again, this was a big risk again, perhaps an even bigger one.
This has paid off, like, because I'd never heard of Guardians of the Galaxy, to be honest, and the fact that Marvel decided, you know what, we've made so much money, let's see where this goes. I think the success of this is why they announced, like, Black Panther and Captain Marvel, like, characters who you wouldn't necessarily have heard of unless you read the comics and things. Like, Captain Marvel's, like, my favourite superhero ever, and I always thought Black Widow was going to get a movie well before Captain Marvel ever does. But I think that being announced had a lot to do with the success of Guardians of the Galaxy. They're not necessarily thinking we have to stick to, you know, the ones everyone kind of already knows, or like the X-Men and things like that. I know X-Men's completely related to this Marvel universe, but it shows willing to, you know, veer a little lot off course, and it means that the nerds, essentially, you could see, like, MODOK and people like that, you know, who you would never think when this all started, I'm going to see Ms. Marvel have her own film with fucking MODOK and stuff like that. You would never think it could possibly happen. And not just happen, but, like, Angelina Jolie's rumoured to direct Captain Marvel. Like, it's just insane. Like, it's the whole superhero franchise now has become this insane monster. It's just taken on a life of its own, and it's brought some legitimacy to the culture that, you know, we all enjoy and... You know, it's made it socially acceptable now to say, I'm a nerd, do you know?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I was going to say, actually, and you sort of touched on it there, is the cast on Guardians, for, you know, like I say, a sci-fi film, but it involved a tree and a raccoon, a CGI raccoon, is some of the supporting cast. You've got Glenn Close in it. You've got Benicio Del Toro. You've got actors of that capability.
Hey, Frank Langella was in the Masters of the Universe movie. Let's not forget that.
True, but, I mean, would you have expected Glenn Close to have been in this film way back when? Probably not.
You know, they can get these people in now, these really, really well-known Oscar-winning thesps.
It's a confidence of it as well, wasn't it? It's just brimming with confidence.
Exactly.
And that's what made it work.
One of the beauties of this film was the soundtrack, which is just amazing. And it's kind of sweeped, well, I say the nation, the world probably, you know, and bringing them closer to some really obscure music as well, but ultimately brilliant. And it's really easy to listen to again and again and again. And yes, yeah, so that's definitely one of the strengths in my book. Not that the film itself wasn't brilliant, but for me, that's what I brought away from it that is unlike any of the other Marvel films.
And this ties back into what we were saying earlier about how Iron Man and Hulk and Thor were gradually introducing these more fantastical concepts. We wouldn't have got to a point where we could accept a movie like this had we not had such strong work in the movies leading up to it. But also that kind of real-world connective element of, like, the soundtrack and these really recognisable, like, fairly, you know, current, well, recent generational songs even though it was this big space opera going on and there was explosions and planets made out of hollowed out alien skulls and whatnot, and then you had David Bowie turning up on the soundtrack, you kind of went, oh, well, this is just like, this dude's just one of us. He just happens to be having a crazy adventure in space.
Who hasn't, since Guardian soundtrack came out, gone dancing down the road to, you know, Come and Get Your Love by Redburn, wanted to kick stuff?
Yeah.
Well, I have.
Spotify awesome mix.
Yep. I've done about three.
And that's what a lot of people will be doing. Because he does have that real sort of... It's like Avengers in the sense that it's immediately a little bit iconic in films right now. And that's why it was one of the most critically acclaimed, actually, and fan-loved films of last year. And
it was my favourite film of last year.
Yeah, it was one of mine. It was it's in my top 10. I think it's one of those that people for the Marvel films will always love. But obviously, the success of that tees up at the end of our journey, the end of our podcast journey, the reason we're all here today, to talk about where we currently stand, which is the brand new Avengers Age of Ultron.
I was designed to save the world. People who look to the sky and see hope. I'll take that from them first. There's only one path to peace. Their extinction.
Strings free, free from strings. No.
To start off with, I'm going to ask you individually, each of you, right, whether you like this. Now, I want a yes or no answer, and then we'll talk about it in general. So I'm going to go through each of you. So, Layden.
Yes.
Yes. Lee.
Yes.
Emma.
Yes.
Okay, calm down.
Hell yes.
Dan.
Yes.
Tom likes it. Oh,
I'm so glad, because I knew if we didn't like it, Emma was not going to let that one stand.
I did actually text Lee before and was like, if they say they don't like it, I'm just going to, like, I'm a bitch fit and sign off.
Okay, I've got to be honest, I did like it,
but
not nearly as much as I wanted to, or I thought I would.
Emma's actual words, everybody, were, I'm going to get really pissed off when everyone starts slagging off Age of Ultron, it's awesome, everyone else is full of shit.
It's okay that you didn't like it as much as you thought you were going to, because I liked it enough for about 40 people. I was not prepared on any level, and we all know this because I've been counting down for long enough to not like this film. It was not going to happen. I know. Do you know what? I went to the cinema, and like, obviously, I kind of knew sort of what was going to happen in the end, but it just reminded me of why I love film so much. It was this joy of, like, not knowing what was going to happen next. And I was worried I wouldn't be as excited for it on the actual day, because I knew, like, I'd already seen the team together in Avengers Assemble and whatnot. But once I sat down and it started, like, that same just rapture that I felt last time was there again. And it was... someone else talk. I just need.
Was it that first slow motion hero shot when they're fighting the Hydrogoons in the snow and they all just burst out and you get the lovely little five shot.
The comic book panel.
I kind of argue that that original fight sequence was the strongest fight sequence of the whole film.
Yeah.
You see, my favorite action scene is the whole chase sequence in Korea with Cap and Black Widow. That's on multiple levels. It's just incredibly well directed.
Gotta sleep.
Yeah.
Which was just like, I'm going after Bruce Banner now. I punched my brother so hard in the arm and went, oh my god, the Hulkbuster's coming! Like, I'd be
Veronica.
Veronica.
Yeah. I'm called Veronica.
I literally got violent. I was so excited for this scene. My brother was just like, fucking stop punching me. I was just like, it's happening. Yeah. It's finally happening. And then my boyfriend kind of leaned over and went, I think the Hulkbuster's coming up. And I was just like, no shit, Sherlock. I felt really sorry for my boyfriend during this, because he kept, like, when they said about Wakanda, he leaned over and went, that's where Black Panther's from and that's where Vibranium comes from. And I was like, oh, baby, I know. Thank you for trying, love.
Yeah. I know what you mean, that obviously the Hulkbuster scene was great, and the Cap and Black Widow scene was also good, but obviously that earlier scene was all of the heroes together, which then you compare it to the final scene with all the heroes together, and that, I just almost got a bit seasick. There was just so much going on. The editing wasn't the best, that at sometimes there would be characters flying across the screen because it'd been mashed together so much, that there was just too much going on, that I lost moments. And again, the best thing about this film were the quieter moments. Like anything with Hawkeye, surprisingly for me, was brilliant. I went in thinking Hawkeye will probably not do anything in this film. He'll just be bubbling along the surface, but he almost stole the show in a lot of ways. And I go back to actually what I said quite a while ago. I said that because obviously they kind of said that they're going to kill somebody. And I said that if they don't kill off one of the main Avengers, the only person they can get away with killing off would be Black Widow, in the fact that it would cause the most kind of, I don't know what everyone can say controversy, but it would mean the most to the fans. And I kind of feel that the decision they did go with kind of confirmed that. I didn't really honestly care that character died.
See, I thought, I was watching my brother going, well, as soon as Hawk had a family, I was like, well, he's fucking dead, isn't he?
So did I! So I was like,
they've made it so obvious that won't. But because they've made it so obvious and we think they won't, they will. Because my brother went, they won't kill Hawkeye now. And I was like, it's just fucking Whedon, of course he will. Yeah. And when he was doing to Scarlet Witch, and he was like saying, when they were on the floating city at the end, and he was going on about, like, none of this makes sense. Like, he's giving her that big speech. I was like, this is his... Yeah, exactly. That's why I texted you, saying this was his I'm a leaf on the wind bit, and I was expecting a fucking arrow through his head or something.
Yeah, this
and I kind of held my breath every time he was on screen. Yeah,
this was like the
Walking... No.
It was definitely like the Walking Dead treatment, where the character that is not seen for almost the whole series gets a whole beginning of the episode, then dies at the end. This is exactly what I thought they were going to do with Hawkeye.
I'll tell you why I knew Hawkeye wouldn't die. Because we know he's in a civil war. Now, this is my problem, right? I did enjoy it, but I've got to tell you why I don't think it's a great film, and I don't think it's one of Marvel's best at all, right? I've got to tell you this. I'm sorry, Emma, I've got to get this out.
That's right, I'm not going to listen.
I think I'm going to agree, so...
This is the problem I have with this. The fact that we know the next 5, 6, 7 films has damaged Age of Ultron in a big way, right?
I've got a positivist, but carry on.
Right, we knew that Hawkeye... I know Hawkeye was going to be in Civil War. I knew Scarlett Johansson was going to be in Civil War. You know, I knew that Falcon's going to be in Civil War. You know, all these characters that... Yes, I heard there was going to be a death as well. When it was the death that happened, was just said, I didn't care either, because we didn't spend enough time with the character. B... It was the fact that it felt arbitrary. And my problem with this, my biggest problem, is that it feels like the Joss was squeezed out of it a hell of a lot. Now, in the first Avengers, Joss Whedon's, he's all over that. His paw prints are all over it. In this, it's only certain points where I believe this was the film that Joss Whedon set out to make. Crucially, all the comedy stuff, which is great, and it works almost, all the stuff with Thor's hammer and all that stuff, it works pretty much as good as anything in the first Avengers film. I loved that. The final moment of Captain America being cut off, perfect, great.
Oh, I wanted to punch someone.
It's pure Joss, it's great. Now, and Ultron, the reason I loved Ultron so much is because he's pure Joss Whedon himself. His whole petulant child mixed with a psychotic Skynet, he's wonderful, right? And with a bit of Tony Stark in there, obviously, as well.
That shot of Vision picking up Force Hammer was just brilliant.
So it was perfect.
Their eyes,
so perfect.
Although I also love
passing it to him,
and I also love the second bit when he comes back in and then they start discussing the weight of a hammer. It's like Force so happy. He has a friend now.
It felt like there were too many points where Marvel and Kevin Feige come in and said, "We need this here. We need this here. We need him to be there. We need him to be there." The whole Thor subplot, right, for a start. I don't believe a lot of that was Joss Whedon at all. In fact, a lot of that was cut down, right? And I just... It just felt totally arbitrary in order to get the vision about the Infinity Gem. Okay, that all does tie in with Ultron and everything like that. I get that. But it also gives him the vision that's totally teeing up Ragnarok. It was just like, well, the first Avengers didn't need any of this. The first Avengers film had its own story and its own plot, and it seeded things for later, but it didn't so overtly go, oh, right, well, that Civil War's coming, so we've got to set that up, we've got to make sure that happens. Right, Ragnarok's coming, so we've got to make sure that happens. Infinity War, We didn't know about any of that stuff back then. We didn't know that the next Avengers was going to be called Age of Ultron. We didn't know the next Thor was going to be called the Dark World. You know, we know too much, and it unfortunately means that the individual film... It's like when you're a writer and you plan out 10 seasons of your show before you've written the first 3 episodes, right? You don't want to write the first 3 episodes then because you're so in love with what happens in season 9. This is the problem, in that we know too much now, and Marvel, for the first time, I felt like this was things being slot into place for plot purposes.
May I riposte?
Right, well, can I just quickly? No, I just didn't, and it meant I just could not fall in love with this film, and I had, and it was too, it was also darker and they had less colour in it. It wasn't as exciting or as punchy as Avengers. It felt reheated, a lot of it. It didn't give me that same sense of buzz as the first Avengers film, and I think it had some great things, but I think it had a lot wrong with it, and I think it will be better second time around. Pete, riposte, by all
means. May I riposte? You say that we know what everything that's going, you know, a lot of things that's going to be happening in the future, and that's fair enough. We all do, but I think you have to forget that you're forgetting here that there's a general audience that may not do. There's a larger audience out there. The first film took $1 billion at the box office. This could well do the same. I don't think everyone who's going to watch it also knows the entire Marvel plan, as a certain set of people do. With that in mind, I don't think that the enjoyment of the film in and of itself would have been hampered for all these people who don't know what's going on, because I don't think there's so much that suddenly sticks out to sight. This has nothing to do with anything. I'm completely confused. Because even the bits, like you say, the bit where Thor dips himself in a swimming pool just to, you know, get his top off of the ladies, also ties in a little bit later on, because that does lead to the creation of the Vision. So people might not be totally lost by it. So I don't think there's too much, but I think that's a case where we can't divide ourselves from what we already know, from what the audience at large might not know.
I do feel like there were pieces being moved into place too much.
As
much as I like Anthony Mackie, I don't really know why he was there. And the same with War Machine as well. I just felt that those characters, and particularly the four subplot for me was so glaringly obvious that it kind of got in the way. And in the end, you kind of lost bits with the Hulk, where he ends up, obviously... Oh, I don't really want to spoil it, but I'm going to anyway. Where he exits, as it were, and you lose a lot of his reasoning as to why, I think, because you lose certain extra scenes that perhaps could have been allocated to him that explains his reasoning for doing what he ends up doing.
The Hulk's a funny one in this, because he kind of, in a way... I can't think of any one Hulk moment like he had in Avengers, like the Hulk smash or any of the other cool, or the puny god or the other bits that he had that were just these great moments. But overall, the Hulk banner plot as it goes throughout the film is a really strong, consistent one. So it kind of balances out. Rather than being a couple, like 4 or 5 moments dotted throughout, it's one really strong through line that goes
through. We're on a big emotional journey in this one, I think.
I can make a strong case that Mark Ruffalo is the MVP of Age of Ultron, because he did much.
I agree. I know he said a couple of months ago in an interview how he was a showcase in this film, how the Hulk's as scared of Bruce Banner as Bruce Banner is of the Hulk. And I think to a certain extent, he did achieve that. I mean, it seemed to me, do you know when Black Widow was singing him a lullaby? He kind of seemed like, you got this sense that the Hulk was kind of irritated, and during the Hulkbuster fight, when Iron Man mentions Bruce Banner, and he starts screaming, and Iron Man goes, oh yeah, right, don't mention puny Banner. Like, the Hulk is scared of Bruce Banner, because Bruce Banner is actively trying to control him, and, you know, basically kill him, because they're almost like, they're like two... people, aren't they? They're two different people, two different personalities in one body. Whereas Bruce Banner is scared of the Hulk because he knows what the Hulk can do. So, and I do agree with what you just said. I think Mark Ruffalo is probably the best actor in this film. But can we talk about Ultron? Because I thought Ultron was as scary as fuck.
Yeah, he was.
Like, Freddy's asked to go see this film, and I've said no because of Ultron, because I think he would be far too scared. That first scene where he showed up and he's like dragging his leg, and the voice, and oh, it was on. I was like, this is too scary.
Kind of creepy.
See, I saw this before we had any showings of this, so I kind of knew the tone it was going to, and there have been lots of kids that have come to see this. I'm like, they are too young. In the opening minutes, there's probably one of the worst swear words said.
Language.
Ultron particularly is very scary, and we have had lots of kids, young children, leave because it's too scary. And it is. You kind of said to me about the fact that there was not a lot of colour in there, and it was a lot darker, I think, than the Avengers and a lot of Phase 1. And I think that's kind of true of Phase 2. Phase 2 was a lot darker, a lot more serious. Okay. But it worked in the solo films, particularly I think in Iron Man 3 and particularly in Winter Soldier, and didn't work so much in this because it wasn't quite as exciting, I guess, and colourful, and as you've kind of already plainly said, not enough Joss in it to make it what Avengers was.
I liked it. I'd say I didn't like it as much as I thought I would. I thought there's a bit of an issue with pacing at times. I want to call back to something I said about 2 hours ago about the villain of the first Avengers having an extra film to establish himself. Ultron seemed to... I quite like the pace that Ultron was there, and then, but then he suddenly went from being you are all puppets to like wanting to kill every single person. It just seemed to happen.
That was the greatest impression of Ultron ever. You're all puppets. You're all puppets.
We missed a trick having James Spader. We should have hired Latham to do a Mancunian accent.
We're busy alienating all of our audience.
You know what? It's basically all of Tony Stark's machines going on strike. Miners. Because we're treating like robots.
You're comparing Ultron's attack to the miners' strike.
We're all treating like robots.
Brilliant.
And in an election year as well.
Latham needs to be cast as Arthur Scargill's stat.
Latham needs to stop doing that accent immediately.
But nobody meat cake.
I may sound like a doubting Thomas, but I did really enjoy it. I really did. And I think it's still a perfectly good film. And I hope I fall in love with it more, as you guys have done, in following, seeing it again. But I think the general consensus from most people is it's not as good as the first Avengers, but it's still great. And
yeah.
Yeah. And that's really good because it tees up the films to come in a big way, obviously. You know, the next up is Ant-Man, which we will be reviewing later in the summer on Black Hole Cinema. And then, of course, it all carries on with Civil War next year. So next March, I believe, or April. So it's just the beginning, really, in many ways. This may be the end of Phase 2, but this is just the start. Unless the superhero bubble bursts, but I hope it doesn't, and I hope it carries on. Do we think it will? Do we think we're close to a point now of oversaturation?
Not yet,
but we will do. I think all the DC movies are going to kill it off, personally, because I don't think they're going to have they're not going to have the same level of care of attention. They're not going to be as much fun. There's just going to be things that aren't as right or aren't as well put together about them. And I just think the sheer volume of them that are going to be coming out over the next 5 or 6 years, that's what's going to really... The public aren't going to have the patience to sit through all these things, but we're still going to have them shoved down our throat with summer tentpole movies for the next 6 years, whether we like it or not, exactly.
Subject to Aquaman.
Yeah, and the second one of them doesn't do well, then they're just going to, in a panic, cancel a load of them, as we saw happen with the whole Spider-Man franchise that was being set up.
I think the MCU is bulletproof, at least until Infinity War, but then... Who knows?
Well, they're going to take some more risks, though, in the Phase 3, because think about it, there are a few films... I mean, Spider-Man will be mega. I think that will probably be the biggest hitter, actually. But then you've got, depending on who they cast as well, but I think then you've got, films that are a bit unknown quantities. You've got, like, Black Panther. You've got Doctor Strange. These are characters who aren't... Like Iron Man,
Doctor Strange. Doctor Strange played by Benedict Cumberbatch. So that balances that up.
That will help that in a big way. And I think that's why they've got such a well-known actor to play Doctor Strange, because he's a very, very tricky part that's going to be in a very, very tricky corner of the Marvel
book. Again, that'll be like Thor and Guardians introducing into a new area of the universe again.
But they've got to get that tonally right. Like Guardians got it spot on tonally. That's going to be a tricky beast. So they're going to have to take... But Marvel, in fairness, even though people accuse them of being samey, they aren't afraid of taking risks and throwing the dice a little bit. So, they'll do that again in Phase 3. They've got a weight of, success behind them. So... I don't see why they won't carry on, you know, doing well going forward. But they've just got to hope, like you guys have said, that the other superhero franchises around them don't collapse. Because if they do, then the pressure's going to be on Marvel even more.
One sense that I got from the end of Age of Ultron is that moment where we introduce, you know, our recruits for who's potentially going to be part of the team going forward. There was a bit of a hint of sadness that, like, oh, you know, we've seen the last of the team that we've, you know, become so attached to over the next 5 or 6 years. Are we going to fall in love with the people that... Because the Avengers obviously have had a rotating membership of dozens of different superheroes over the years, but we've gotten so used to these guys. Now that some of them aren't potentially going to be there anymore, you know, is it like, oh, this is it now? It's not going to be as good again because it's not going to have those same people in it. Or are the new people that come along going to be as good, and are we going to fall in love with them just as hard?
I think if you believe that they're not going to come back for Infinity War, I think we're pretty much all kidding ourselves.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, there's enough fan favourites in there. I know Vision has automatically become a bit of a fan favourite, hasn't he? So,
well, Pete, it's kind of said it twice. Infinity War almost up until that point is bulletproof. And the fact is that you know Thor will probably be back for that. And I don't know whether both Iron Man and Captain America will be, but I suspect one of them will definitely be there. You'd lean more towards Captain America, I think, because ultimately you can't see some of the replacements, as it were. You can't see War Machine fighting Thanos, for example, and yeah, you certainly can't see the poor old human Falcon fighting Thanos. Yes. Well, it's like he's like a weaker version of, you know, both him and War Machine are kind of weaker versions of what we've already got. Whereas obviously we know the Vision is pretty powerful, and Scarlet Witch has shown she can be pretty powerful. So they can be additions to our team. But those two, I think, are almost kind of gone in there as cannon fodder.
Yeah, I just hope they're not setting up a team whose job it is to get murdered in part one so that the other guys can come back in part two and avenge them.
I almost wouldn't be surprised if Falcon dies in Civil War and War Machine dies at the end of Infinity War.
As long as nothing happens to Scarlet Witch, I'll be just fine.
I'd be very surprised if Rodney Downey Jr. isn't in Infinity War.
Yeah.
I'd be amazed. I think he will be. I think, like you say, I think they'll all be back for a final, and it will be the last one, I think, for people like Chris Evans, Chris Hemsworth, Robert Downey Jr.
Sam Jackson.
I think it will be the last one for a lot of them. I think that will be it. Whether they'll kill them off or whatever, I don't know, or they'll retire them. But I think then by then they'll have worked up as a lot of other characters that they can hope that hopefully will have built up and be as beloved, you know, Doctor Strange, Black Panther, Spider-Man. They'll all be loved enough so they can carry on into Phase 4 with a whole new roster and a whole new set of films and everything like that. But it's interesting because this is where it gets risky. This is where it really does get risky.
Mm-hmm.
It will be fascinating to revisit this, to do a podcast for Infinity War in 4 years. 3 or 4 years, and see how different the landscape looks. So, should we put that in our diaries now?
Should we have as many panelists as there are Avengers?
We need more. We'll get everyone on for that. We'll have
12
of us.
As I said, we need to quadruple our fan base here, don't we? Make sure we've got enough Avengers.
We need 12 people on, and we're going to kill off several of them in the first half. and then we're left with like four. but yeah, that leads me to officially pull down the curtain for this episode. This is the biggest Black Ops cinema yet. It's the longest. I will probably spend the next 5 weeks editing. But thank you all for sticking with it. We've gone on a bit later than we hoped, but thank you for sticking with it. And it just leaves me to say goodbye, Matt Latham.
Goodbye, Matt Latham.
Goodbye, Dan Taylor.
Goodbye, Dan Taylor.
Goodbye, Emma Platt.
Trap.
has to
goodbye,
be unique.
Pete D. Gaskell.
And goodbye from you.
And finally, goodbye, Mr. Lee Crimes.
Good night and good luck.
We'll see you in Phase 3. Bye, guys.
What just happened? We won.
All right, hey. All right, good job, guys. Let's just not come in tomorrow. Let's just take a day.